Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. The Be Fulfilled Journal helps you be more honest with yourself and with others and be more open to handling things you've avoided dealing with for years. It's a 12-week online and journal program that helps you identify and eliminate things you do that are causing you stress and live in more gratitude and joy. It was actually developed by a long-term friend of mine who got sober in 2008, and he's put together a great deal just for my listeners. You get the 300-page hardcover journal and access to the 12-week video program online, plus free shipping, plus membership in a private Facebook support group with others going through the program, plus a 5-day mini course showing you how to let go of stuff that's draining your energy, plus a 30-day 100% money-back guarantee. To start your journey and get all the bonuses, go to befulfilledjournal.com/ELG. That's befulfilledjournal.com/ELG. For information about advertising on Everyone Loves Guitar, including information on geographically targeted ads, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. We got a super interesting guest, a real talented and interesting player. We're with Frank Symes. I'm going to go through his bio and ask him some questions chronologically. He was really cool how he wrote it out. So you've heard Frank play, whether or not you've realized that you've heard Frank play or not. But honestly, he's got a great background. So he started playing music when he was 10. And thanks so much for coming on the show, Frank. And I want to give a shout out to Steve DeStanislaw for hooking us up. Yeah. So he started playing music when he's 10. At the time, he was living on a U.S. Army base in Japan. He got a guitar for Christmas, but he didn't even know how to tune it, so he made up a random chord. But it's not exactly a random chord. It's E minor add 9, and he starts playing it as an arpeggio. And he named all his kids E minor add 9 as a result. No, I'm just kidding. He loses himself in the sound, and it was really compelling to him. So he starts practicing guitar every day for hours on end. And at 14, I'm not making this up, at 14, he's offered a record deal with RCA Victor Japan. So Frank, how the hell did that happen?
Well, I was obsessed about playing guitar, and my sister played a little bit of guitar, and she taught me how to play Love Me Tender. And there was a lot of music in the house anyway. My mom loved Ray Charles, The Platters, Stan Getz, Ramsey Lewis. My sister listened to Miles Davis and Elvis Presley. Anyway, I was just playing all kinds of music at home and figuring things out on my own and whatnot. By the time I was when I was 14, I teamed up with these guys from a naval base. David Nielsen and Steve Fox. Actually, Steve Fox became a bass player for Japan's largest rock band, most successful rock band.
That's wild.
There was a child prodigy keyboardist named Miki Yoshino, and he had just faced charges, drug charges, actually, and the court told him he has to quit the band he's in, a huge band called the Golden Cups. And so he had to quit the band by court order.
Like recently?
No.
This is back then.
When I'm 14. And so he wanted to form a new band. He called Steve Fox and he goes, "Do you know a guitar player that would, that wants to start a band?" And Steve called me, and I went over to Mickey's house. And Mickey was like a, celebrity. It's like going over to, Pete Townsend's house or something. Yeah. And so we got together and we had the simpatico between us. The vibe was great. And we said, "Let's put a band together." And,
how old were these guys? They were much older than you, I assume.
He was 18, and Steve Fox was, I think, a couple years older than me. So Steve was either 16 or – I think Steve was 17 and Mickey was 18.
That's wild.
The singer was 16. The drummer was 16, David Nielsen. Jeff McMahon was the singer. And then we put this band together, and we got scouted by a famous singer who's my age, a girl named Ann Lewis, who had a crush on me. And she brought the producer down to our rehearsal place, and our producer heard it and said, "Let's bring you into the studio." Next thing I know, I'm in the studio, at RCA Victor Japan, you know, beautiful studio, and I'm playing my Les Paul. I, you know, saved up my money to buy a gold top Les Paul.
Wow.
I have a photo I will send you.
Do you still have that guitar?
I don't, but I have a 54 gold top now.
Oh, wow. Upgraded. Wow, that's pretty cool. What a story, man.
Yeah.
Okay, so then his dad moves back to the States, and he's got a choice. He could stay in Japan with his mom. That was it. They gave you that choice. That was pretty cool of them, actually.
Yeah, my dad was very liberal. I mean, he was highly educated and came from a pretty conservative background, but he himself was very liberal minded. And I said, you know, I talked him into letting me go to LA on my own. And, you know, he said, you know, it's up to you, Frank. You can stay in Japan and pursue your record deal, or you can come with me. And you know, they had split up.
Sure. What? And, what made you say I need to go to LA? That's pretty. I give you a ton of credit, man. That's ballsy as hell.
You know, I was by then. You know, I was listening to, you know, American and English bands. You know, I was listening to, you know, Jimi Hendrix and you know, Beatles and Led Zeppelin, and you know, later and other bands, Blues Image, all kinds of bands. You know, John Mayall. I was into the Doors, and you know, everywhere I'd look, I'd see LA, Los Angeles, recorded in Los Angeles, you know, Sunset Sound or somewhere, you know, in LA. And you know, I would see that there was this culture, this bustling place in LA. I mean, that was the mecca of music, and I knew that when I was as young as 12, probably. And I had always dreamt of coming to LA.
So you went back to San Diego with your dad, and you convinced him to let you live in L.A.
I convinced him I could make my way in L.A., and it's really amazing. He said, well, one thing you have to promise me is that you can't quit school. And I said, don't worry. You know, I was a straight-A student. I didn't want to quit school. I figured I'll just go to school, and at Fairfax High, they had wonderful music classes, you know, theory classes, you know, musicianship classes. I played clarinet and flute in a band.
Amazing to think that they had theory and music classes at one point in time in high school, isn't it?
Yeah, they were very advanced, and I became a teacher's aide because I was pretty advanced in my music knowledge, and so they made me a teacher's aide for music theory 1, 2, and 3, I think.
That's pretty cool. Uh-huh. So you at 15, you step off the bus at the downtown Greyhound bus station. So what the hell was that? What was your first impression of LA? And after living in Japan for your whole life, I got to believe it was a tremendous culture shock.
Well, you know, Tokyo is a very, you know, well-kept, clean place. And the people are polite. And, you know, it's like an ant colony of, you know, the population is so huge. But the people are very respectful there, you know. And when I stepped off the bus at the Greyhound bus station, is it at Hill in Los Angeles? It was bewildering. I mean, it was downright terrifying.
Yeah, it had to be, yeah.
I had never seen a place like that. It looked dirty. It looked, you know, sordid.
There's usually like prostitutes and drug addicts. Yeah.
Within 5 minutes of getting off the bus, a guy in a black trench coat comes up to me and offers me balloon bags of heroin.
Nice.
And I went, no thanks. And then later I was walking around Hollywood and I see, you know, porn theaters and prostitutes on corners. And it was, you know, bewildering. It was definitely a culturally shocking.
So let me ask you this. When you see that stuff, it had to be scary at a minimum.
Yeah, in a word, yes.
How did you process that? Like, you don't really have the coping skills to draw on at that young of an age. What's going through your head as far as like, you know, I'm sure at some point you said, man, maybe this wasn't the right decision, or how did you stay focused on, okay, let me just get a place to live, so on and so forth?
Well, a couple decades later, I figured out in retrospect that I had to be my own parent. I was trying to develop as a teenager, but I had to also kind of look after myself at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
And the two roles I had to play, at least two roles I had to play, was too much internal pressure for me.
Oh,
and I started having anxiety syndrome, anxiety attacks, and I had to overcome that. And but music helped me through that as well. I gave myself self music therapy by whistling, humming, and singing, and that helps every time. So,
how did you go find a place? Like, how did you even know how to find a place to live at that age?
Well, I just, you know, they had a, I think they had something like Recycler or something like that. And I found an apartment agency, you know, okay. or, you know, a place that offered homes and apartments. And I called them up and I said, I'm looking for a place to stay. And I found this place at Ogden and Romaine in West Hollywood. And it's a Jewish neighborhood. And it's a pretty safe neighborhood. And it was a converted garage with French doors, and it had two rooms and a kitchen and a bathroom, okay. and it was $105 a month.
Oh my God.
And I had no furniture. Except a twin mattress on the floor. And I rented a piano for $15 a month. I heated the place with a stove. The bathroom looked like something out of a medieval dungeon. I didn't want to go. And I had little money. My grocery for the month was like a jar of large Skippy peanut butter and a loaf of white bread that you could squeeze into a little ball like that.
Yeah.
A bag of little apples. And that was about what I had to eat. And I lost a lot of weight.
Wow. Did you, so did your dad know the conditions with underwear you were like?
You know, my dad just like, he didn't even want to know. And he never even came up. Not once. He never came to see me perform. He saw me perform once when I was in the seventh grade, I think. But that might have been the magic show I did. Anyway, he only saw me perform once, and he never came up. He was just like...
Why? I mean, nothing. I'm not making a judgment, but like, you're a parent. You're a parent. I'm a parent. It's like no fucking way in hell. Like, I'd be shitting myself. And I'm fairly liberal, but not like that liberal.
Well, I'll tell you a little background on my dad. He was sent away to a boarding school when he was 8 years old. And and in the cold autumn of whenever it was, you know, it must have been 1915. His father put a loaded revolver in his overcoat pocket and sent him off by himself when he was 8 years old.
Oh, so his frame of reference was, hey, man, I've done so much of a better job than my dad. He just didn't know any better when it comes down to it.
He didn't know any better. Yeah. He didn't. He had no sense of family. Yeah. He really and he had as many regrets, and he really loved me. Toward the end, we reconciled everything. And because part of the reason I moved to LA was because I really couldn't stand him for not participating in my life up until I was 15. And, by the time I turned about 18, 19, 20, I had reconciled all my issues with my dad.
It's pretty good that you were able to do that at such a young age.
Yeah. There was a critical moment when I finally told him, I said, Dad, I've hated you all my life. And he burst into tears and he said, well, hate is a strong word. And I said, I'm being honest. And because I was honest, ironically, it flipped the relationship around and we embraced. And from that moment on, we were like old pals, old, dad and son at last.
Was it tough to forgive him?
I think being able to say that I had, felt so intensely against him really actually relieved a lot of pressure, because when you hold it in, that's you have. Yeah. So, I was very honest with him and he trusted me from that point on because there was so much honesty between us.
Wow. It's good that you got to do that. I've had issues. I had many issues with my dad. I would never have that conversation with him.
Right.
I mean, I haven't seen him in 40 years or 30 years or something like that. But, shit happens. You play the cards, as you know, man. You don't pick the cards. You just play the ones you're dealt,
Yeah.
And, but that's good that you got to do that.
That's right. Yeah. Well, that's an interesting analogy about cards. I did think of a solitaire analogy with life. You're dealt a certain,
hand. Deck. Yeah.
And it's about how you play it that makes all the difference.
Yeah,
are
totally.
Are you paying attention? Are you keeping track of the details?
Yeah, totally.
Are you seeing the overall picture? Are you playing the best you can?
And there's a little luck involved sometimes, as just like in cards.
But, you know, there's a distribution curve with luck. And, you know, by and large, everyone gets handed a certain amount of bad luck and good luck.
Yeah,
you know?
I agree.
So it's really about, you know, what you make of it, I think.
Yeah.
Some people, are held really bad hands. But
yeah. But I think the thing is you can't change that.
No.
So, like, it's wasted energy to some extent to lament. You know, you got to fix, heal, whatever. But, right. Man, I learned you just can't, you know, like, it's like bitching about the price of lettuce, you know, like,
yeah.
What do you, okay, whatever that is, like, what are you going to do about it, right? So you just got to move forward, man. Good for you that sounds great, man. So you had great survivor skills from a young age.
It must have, you know.
Whether you liked it or not.
epigenetically or genetically, I don't know. I mean, I always had the ability to focus, you know, whether it was, now I do, we'll talk about it later, but, you know, fine arts and writing stories, poetry, writing songs, you know, I think I have a really good skill in that I can focus like a laser on things. And that has helped me. And I think I've had that all my life.
So it's interesting. I've never thought about this until you just mentioned it. I wonder if having the stress helped that, because I'm the same way, man. I'm like, if I need to hone in, that's almost like a forte, you know? And I wonder if that, if that's something that's developed, you know, like you're sharpening your knife sort of, I wonder if that knife is sharpened through self-parenting or through, you know what I'm saying? I don't know.
Yeah, and, you know, self-parenting, well, you pay a price for it, but it sure does sharpen your survival instincts.
Oh, yeah, big time.
Your survival skills, you know, and you make the best of what you have. And, you know, and you learn to deal with people in such a way to, you know, make the best of every situation, not just take advantage, but, you know, make it advantageous for everyone.
Yeah.
You know, and use diplomacy, you know, you learn to communicate. Use the right words, you know, you try to motivate others, you know, and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
You know, instill enthusiasm in others, you know, that kind of thing.
That's
huge,
putting enthusiasm in others, man.
Collaborating with others, you know, give and take, you know, you learn all these are components of, you know, making life work. You know?
Yeah, for sure, man.
Making it work.
Okay, yeah. So.
Yes. Back to our story.
Yeah, back to your story. So Frank was driven to be part of the scene, even though he had no connections in the music business. The transcendent feeling he experienced whenever he was deeply immersed in music is something he strived for and still strives for, and that's what, as he mentioned, sustains him through the hard times. What were some specific, you mentioned, you know, this early struggles, hard times you've had to endure that you were referring to?
Well, so... the first one was when I was living in that dumpy garage, converted garage. That was the hard times, but, you know, and playing the piano. I learned how to play the piano, and I'll send you an MP3 of a song I wrote when I was back when I was only 16, 17. I'd only been playing the piano for about 8 months, and you'll hear this.
You learned how to play by yourself?
Well, I had a mentor that was a composition major at USC.
Okay.
You know, that was one of your questions, actually. You know, who was your mentor? And he was definitely a mentor. And,
how'd you hook up with this? When you were at you, how'd you hook up with him?
So I had friends who were attending USC. And actually, I was the guy, my roommate was a major, was a, I don't know what, I think he was just taking general requirement classes, but. Anyway, through him, I met a bunch of others, and there are a bunch of people from Camp Zama, the U.S. Army base from Japan, who attended USC. So it was a little bit of a community that I belong with, too.
That's great.
And even though I was only a sophomore in high school, I was college-age guys, and this guy came in to visit my friend's apartment, and turned out to be this guy named Steve Laughlin, who's a composition major, who's a absolutely brilliant. And he died young, unfortunately, but I learned so much from him.
That's great. It's amazing that you were hanging out with college age people when you were 15 then.
Yeah. Yeah. My first love, actually, I mean, well, second love, I suppose, but was a woman, girl who was 6 years older than me and attending USC. And we hooked up and moved in. I was only 17 when I moved in with
her. Oh, my God. Dude, how many lifetimes have you lived already?
I don't know. Maybe that's why I like cats.
Well, hey, good for you. That's a
anyway,
score.
So you're talking about the hardships. Okay, well, so later on in life, I got scouted by Martha Davis. You know who that is? Of the Motel.
Yes, yeah.
We can play.
Yeah. Right?
And her musical director and manager saw me play at what's now the Viper Room. It used to be called the Central. And I got scouted. I was playing there with my band called Mercy Train, and I wound up auditioning for Martha Davis. I won the audition out of about 20 guitar players, I guess, and I started working, and we got along really well, musically and otherwise, and we became really close friends, and I started producing her, and I started getting a weekly paycheck from Capitol Records.
Well, that must have made you feel like $1 million.
Yeah, just to have that position. You know, yeah. Never. The money wasn't great, but it was enough to live on. And then she got dropped from the label for some reasons I won't get into now. But and my job went with her being dropped.
Oh.
So I had just, my first daughter had just been born.
Were you married at the time? Or?
I was married. And then I went on before she got dropped from the label, I went on a 3.5-month tour of Australia. We did some dates in California, and I thought this was going to continue. This was my change, getting on the other side of the fence,
so yeah.
From playing clubs and doing local stuff and then, you know, doing tours. So I was playing with Martha Davis, and then I was producing her music. We were co-writing, doing all sorts of things, and then my job just evaporated. And so I didn't have any money, and I was fell into a depression. Just went down a downward spiral, and you know, I actually drove up the Angeles Crest Highway, and I was determined to drive off the cliff.
What held you back?
Every last moment, I was in the rough already, and accelerating, and my heart was beating fast, and then suddenly I hallucinated this voice that went, "Not yet," like that, and you know, it was like. The universe talking to me, you know, I'm sure it was like a survival instinct, you know, a mechanism in my brain telling me, no, don't do it. And I kind of obeyed the command, so to speak. And
holy shit.
Careening in the rough. And I managed to stop before I flew off the cliff. And I just sat there, regained my composure, caught my breath, made a U-turn, drove home, went to bed, woke up the next day, and then... You know, Friedrich Nietzsche, the 19th century philosopher,
he said,
creativity is your salvation. So I took that to heart and started writing music, writing songs, one after another, no matter what. And that really saved my life. And it saved me through the darkest times. And that was probably the absolute darkest moment of my life.
Thanks for sharing that. How did you, how long did it take till you started making money and like what did you do?
So, not long after that, I got a call from, her tour manager who was actually the permanent tour manager for Don Henley.
Mm.
Don Henley had just fired a guitarist and needed a replacement and a good, you know, a feather in Chris Littleton, the tour manager's, cap. If he could recommend a good guitar player.
Yeah.
And great. So he goes, this will be perfect for you. And so I went and did the audition and Don Henley picked me right away. He goes, he came right up to me after I did, you know, Boys of Summer and Dirty Laundry and
some good songs back then.
Hotel California. And he goes, well, you're the guy. If you can work out the money, you're the guy. That's what he said.
That's
right away.
Really cool.
I was taken aback, like, oh, so soon? Like, you don't have to think about this. You know?
When he said if you could work out the money, was he like on the cheap side or something, or just men in general?
No, Don Henley was very generous, actually.
Okay, cool.
Very generous guy when it came to money.
That's cool.
And yeah.
Sometimes when people say if you could work out the money, it's like, be prepared. You're not going to get paid.
I just had to negotiate with the accountant, you know, and the accountant's, of course, protecting Don Henley. And so, you know, he's going to try to.
Yeah.
Me down a little, but you know, he was asking like, well, who have you played with? How much were you making? You know, that kind of stuff, you know, like, you know how it goes.
Yeah.
But anyway, at that time I was down in the dumps, you know, financially, and I started working doing film crew work, and I was working doing commercials. I would find myself on a 10-story building, on a 3-story scaffold on top of the 10-story building, building something without a safety net or anything, no cables, nothing. And I just asked myself, what am I doing up here? And the head of the company called me and said, you know, we realize, you know, this is not for you. You know, this is not your, you weren't born to do this.
I said, goodness.
He goes, but you show up on time, you're a hard worker, so we want to offer you a job as a truck driver for a company. And I said, great.
That's cool, you know, yeah.
$150 a week, you know. And but then at the same time, like the on the answering machine, the Don Henley's accountant was going, okay, well, you have the gig with Don now. So it was like this, you know, fork in the
feast or famine, man. That's the way it goes sometimes.
Truck driver or play with Don Henley, you know.
That's so cool, man.
So I started making better money with Don Henley. And then I became his, like, you know, kind of like a right-hand man, and eventually became a band leader for a while and helped create a new band for him. I was the only guy left in the band. He fired everyone else.
That's really cool. Were you, man, I give you credit. That's, yeah, sometimes when you're that down, wow. Hmm. Did you, were you still married at that time?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And had two daughters, and, you know, Jessica and Audrey.
Very good.
Yeah.
All right. So back to the story, rises up through the ranks, winds up playing with Don Henley, Stevie Nicks and Mick Jagger, and ultimately becomes a musical director for Roger Daltrey and The Who. He also, and I'm going to ask you about that in a minute. He also became a composer for Paramount TV. All of this is surreal and otherworldly, but it's the story of how my resolve, passion, and focus drive me on and help me do better than merely survive against all odds. It's the story of how to connect and resonate ultimately with the universe. Okay, I want to ask you about that first.
Okay.
When you have an upbringing that is difficult,
mm-hmm.
that connection with the universe is not there.
Mm.
The safety net that other do you know Mike Keneally? He's playing with Satriani now. He's been with Joe for 9 years. He played with Dweezil. He played with Frank Zappa. He played with Steve I. Anyway, he's the most amazing guy with this. He wrote an opera called The Universe Will Provide, and he's totally different childhood to yourself, myself. The universal, that's his, like, that's natural for him as it is breathing for you or I. Okay. But when you grow up in a difficult environment without that stability behind you, that universal provide shit isn't really, it's like not something that's, you're not thinking like that. You think, no, I'll provide for my ass, not the universe. How did you get your mindset around to resonate with the universe and believe that?
I think since I was
maybe you are different. Maybe you felt that way since early on.
You know, I have, my father was brilliant. I hardly knew him, but he was brilliant. And my mother was like super kind. We never exchanged one hostile word, my mother and I.
Is your mom Japanese? Artistic.
Yeah, she is. And she was a model, beautiful model, artist. She's a painter, great painter, and she's a successful restaurateur.
That's awesome, man. Wow.
Business mind as well. Anyway, she and I, as I said, didn't exchange one hostile word between us. We always smiled, laughed. There was a good humor between us. We were always happy to see each other. And I think that was probably my emotional saving grace.
Okay, so you felt that stability and the safety from there.
Yeah, I think that definitely. And my sister and I were very close as well.
Okay.
I said when I was 10 years old, I felt, you know, completely absorbed in that cosmic transcendence of music, you know.
Yeah.
And someone might think that's, I don't know, some illusion or something, or delusion, or
I don't think anybody listening to this is thinking that, because if everybody listening to this has had that same, everybody listening to this show is really enraptured by music. So that's probably simpatico.
So that's my hope, that, and I promote music as a source of feeling whole and feeling a part of the universe. You know, I'm not a Taoist, but that's what Taoists say. You know, if you're feeling alienated, isolated, you know, if you're all about your ego, you know, the way, you know, connect back with the universe is go into a forest and become a part of the forest.
Well, right.
Music essentially provides that mode of connecting again.
Yeah.
And to me, I can just slip into that state immediately.
Yeah.
When I have insomnia, I play a little Bach on the guitar and I fall asleep. If I have a panic attack, which I don't anymore, but I hum or sing and or whistle, and it, you know, everything normalizes, you know, not just, I mean, chemically too, the balance of the gases in the body and the sine wave that's of the breath and everything else. And, you know, to me, music has always been therapeutic. I mean, and a source of spirituality for me. It's like the only spirituality I need. I don't need some kind of doctrinaire, you know, religion or organized anything.
Yeah.
You know, I say music is the only religion you need.
Yeah.
Not
no,
for
me. I'm with you on that, man.
You know, and so that's been a source of my sense of spirituality all my life, I think. Mm.
So and you. No, I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead. But, I apologize. Go ahead.
No.
Oh, so the thing with the universe, you had that anchored through your mom and your sister.
I think so, you know, and just. I could easily be absorbed by performance or with performing or creating, or, you know, I just go into this state of, it's a blissful state where, you know, I say in my keynote talks, how it's, it's like touching the eternal, which is like a kind of timelessness. It's, you know, people think eternity is an infinite expanse of time. But to me, it's just the absence of the passage of time. And so, well, that sense, when you feel the absence of time, that's when you know you really connected with music. And I personally think, you know, when I gave a lecture at East LA College, there was this one student who wrote me a letter saying, all that stuff about connecting with the cosmos, that's just a bunch of BS, isn't it? Just admit it, he said. He goes, you were just good at BSing your way to the top, right? Come on, admit it, Frank.
Wow.
I go, you know what? Yeah, I know you know, whatever. He's trying to be mean, or I don't know. Maybe he's trying to find himself in all this, right? Because in the at the end of the letter, he said, well, you gave me a lot to think about.
Oh, so he's just frustrated because he didn't get it, or he's wanting to get somewhere, it sounds like, that he's struggling with.
He thought, you know, I got all these gigs with Don Henley and Mick Jagger and Stevie Nicks because I knew how to, like, BS my way to the top, you know. But the truth of it, from my heart, from the depths of my heart, I can say that when I connected with Mick Jagger, when I auditioned for him, it was because I really connected with him. You know, I was immersed in the music. I caught fire, and we shared a sense of humor almost, and in simpatico, you know, musical happiness, you know, musical joy, right on. And it was on that level that he picked me out of 650 guitar players.
Okay, so let's talk. How did you get that audition? And when, what period of time was that with Mick? What was he doing?
That was in the interim when I played with Don Henley. I joined Don Henley in 89, and I played with him for 20 years off and on.
Wow.
In the interim.
Holy shit. Hold on a minute. That's like 140 years in music world. Yeah, that's wow.
So in that interim, during lulls, you know, in Don Henley's schedule, my friend John Corey got a call to audition for Mick Jagger, but he couldn't because he had been in an accident. He had titanium in his hand and his knees. He was in pain. He called me up and he goes, hey, you want to audition for Mick Jagger? I said, of course. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Kidding? And so I got the audition. Do you want me to go into the story now, the Mick Jagger audition?
Yeah,
story?
Definitely.
So, you know, it's highly intimidating. Mick is auditioning about 20 guitar players in LA, and there are about 20 others in New York City. And I'm waiting in line to audition.
Oh my God, that had to be so stressful.
The guy in front of me played with the Red Hot Chili Peppers. The guy behind me was Steve Ferris of Mr. Mister, hit band in the 80s. You know, very intimidating. Like, you know, gee, how am I going to get this gig? You know? So I walk in, get ready to play, and then in comes Mick in a jovial mood, full of energy, you know, dancing, you know. You know, he goes, let's play. Well, what do you say we play some blues, he says. And I said, sure. And I started playing. It turned out my amp wasn't loud enough. And he goes, you know, it's all well and good and everything. And what's your name, Frank? And he goes, I can't hear you. He goes, can you use a louder amp? So I plugged into a Marshall 100 that was sitting there. And then he'd hear me. And then we were just vibing. And it was, you know, I rose to the occasion. And we were just playing. Oh, so the other thing is that, you know, usually at auditions, they send you a music in advance. So you can learn songs, you know, like with Don Henley. And anybody else I auditioned for, and they send you like 5 songs, and you learn them. You come prepared. Well, there was no such thing with Mick Jagger. He played 12 songs on the monitor, through the monitors, and he said, just learn these songs while you're listening, and then you're going to play them, you know, make up a part on the spot. So we did that 10 or 12 songs. And, so, you know, high pressure, you know, there are 2 cameras on us.
Oh, they're recording this, videoing this.
Oh, recording and videotaping. And I just went into that cosmic space I go into when I play music. And I just want, you know, I smiled and I was like warmly smiling at him and connected with him, you know, as you would playing music with Mick Jagger, you know. I mean, I could have been intimidated to the point where I was freezing, you know, in fear. But I decided, you know what? I'm going to just make the best of this. I want to just make the best of it. I want to play my best. And I did. And that was my decision. I know that. And as far as preparation, you know how they say success or luck is, you know, intersection of opportunity and preparation. Well, I think I've been preparing for this moment all my life. You know, and I just gave it the best shot I could. Well, I went home. And I got a call from his secretary and said, well, Mick would like to know if you're available to help him audition bass players and drummers tomorrow. He just wants to know if you're working. And I said, well, you know, I did have a gig, but I'll cancel it. I'll easily cancel it for Mick. And Mick, and she goes, oh, no, no, Mick wants to talk to you. And he gets on the phone and he goes, Frank, you know, he goes, so you have a gig tomorrow. He goes, how about if I provide a crew and trucking, and that way you could stay with me longer. How's that? Wow. I go, how respectful, how civilized, what a gentleman, I thought. Wow. You know? And I said, well, of course, you know. And so I went down and started helping him audition drummers and bass players. And he was listening to my video. What do you think, Mike? What do you think, Mike?
Did he tell you at that point you got the gig? I mean, when did
he just like come down and help me audition bass players and drummers? And that was like saying, you're in.
Wow.
I had won the spot. And then, you know, as I said earlier, you know, I found out he had 650 guitar players in his database. And I couldn't, you know, couldn't believe that.
That's incredible, man.
So I, you know, we made a video. We spent 3 weeks in England, 3 weeks in New York City. We were going to play CBGB, but something happened. We wound up not doing that. And we played a huge show at the in New York City in the Bowery. At Webster Hall.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure.
And that was televised and, like, simulcasted to 4 different cities, you know. And so, and, you know, Mick was just, like, the most wonderful, generous, humorous, happiest celebrity I'd ever worked with. He was, it was surreal. You know, he would drive this rented Lincoln, this black rented Lincoln. And come on, Frank, let's go. You know, take a ride with me. And we're driving down. So, you hungry, Frank? You know, yeah. What do you like, Mick? Yeah. Are you hungry? Yeah. You know, you like Thai food, Mick? Sure. How about Shandara over here? Okay, let's go. And he's, you know, parallel parking on Cahuenga. And we're getting out of the car.
Man, I got a few questions here. So how long did you that last playing with Mick?
Well, over a year. It was like over a year because rehearsed, did pre-production for the record, made the record, and then we went, we did some traveling. We played on Saturday Night Live. We played at, as I said, Webster Hall, and we made a video, and we were supposed to go on a tour, but Keith Richards called him and said, let's get started on the next Rolling Stones record. And so the whole thing came to a halt after a year. But, you know, still,
yeah.
I had to spend a tour with them. And I went, you know, went to dance halls, you know, with them, you know, and, you know, drank beer and hung out with them, you know. And he was so easy to be around.
What record was that?
It's called Wandering Spirit.
Man, that is so cool. Was it tough, like, you're getting out of a car with Mick Jagger to go to work? Was he immediately mobbed, or how does that work?
Oh, people would, you know, drive by and yell, "Hey, Mick!" You know, and he'd go, "Hey!" You know, and the surprising thing was that he never had a bodyguard. There was he had an assistant, but he was hardly a bodyguard. Hmm. And you know, he had no fear at the rap party, which was at Heidi Fleiss's house, by the way.
That's pretty funny. Wow.
And, you know, Prince was there with four giant guys protecting him. And I'm just wondering, why does he need that much? Why does he need so much protection?
Maybe he was a little weirder than.
I don't know. Maybe Paul McCartney was there. He didn't have any bodyguards. And Mick was running around with, you know, beer in his hand and going, "Frank, are you having a good time?" You know, it's just like. That's the coolest thing about Mick is no fear.
Any funny stories or experiences or interesting experiences through that you haven't talked about?
Oh, let's see. Well, it was just, you know, I was so impressed by how he would sing every take with the band because he wanted to get an overall vibe with the vocals. And then after we would do a take, we'd all go in the control room to hear the track back, and he would start dancing like an 18-year-old. He had the energy of an 18-year-old.
Oh, he's and off the charts.
He was 49, and he was dancing, and we were all just staring at him, watching him just dance to see if the thing grew. You know, the music grew, and he dancing would be the acid test.
Did he tell you any funny or interesting stories about the Stones days, putting the band together or playing, or, you know, Mick Taylor, any stories like that?
He talked about meeting Mark Bolan. He, you know, he thought really highly of Mark Bolan. And so he told me stories about that. You know, what it was like to play in LA, that, you know, he's quite the businessman, and, you know, how the first day's a wash, but, you know, then the 6 days all cream, you know, so like this, stuff like that. You know, he was just like, he's very open about stuff.
Yeah. That's really cool, man.
He's very open.
How'd you hook up with The Who and Daltrey, man? And I'm sure you got some interesting stories there.
Well, unbeknownst to me, there was a film producer named Nigel Sinclair.
God, is that an English name?
Yeah, that is. He's actually Scottish, but a really nice guy. He's my friend as well. So Roger was living in Van Nuys, of all places. Van Nuys, California. He had a compound made of four homes. And people would ask him, why don't you live in Bel Air or something with all your money and everything? And he goes, well, people in Bel Air don't have barbecues with their neighbors. Mm. Anyway, so he, you know, he's like salt of the earth kind of guy, and he lived in, and he had a band called The How. Of course, that's a play on words with The Who, and it was a charity band. It was a 9-piece charity band, and this Nigel Sinclair, film producer, was in the band, and the drummer for the band was someone I helped get a gig with Don Henley during one phase of the band, and so. Roger didn't like his guitar player, so he fired him, and then he got another guy. He was pretty good, but he was more of a blues player, got rid of him. So he asked the band members, don't you know a guy that can play my music? And Nigel and my friend Rob Ladd, drummer, both raised their hand. They both said, we know a guy, Frank. He can play your music. So I was invited down by the musical director, and I set up my stuff, and I was getting ready to play, and then in comes Roger Daltrey. Now, mind you, I had seen Roger Daltrey on Woodstock when I was in Japan, and and he had taken my breath away.
Oh, he's incredible, incredible voice.
Yeah, in Woodstock, he was amazing, and Pete Townsend, too. But anyway, there he is right there, the icon that I've, you know, thought about all my life. And he's not nonchalantly playing Behind Blue Eyes. And I knew the song. I'd been playing it since I was like 13. So I started playing along, and he kind of nodded like, oh, you know this song. Okay. And so he went up to the microphone and started singing.
Wow.
I know all the background vocals, so I sang all the background vocals. There were about 30 people surrounding us, his entourage or whatever. And we got through playing the entire song, and then he reaches out and he goes, Roja. And I said, Frank, nice to meet you. And so the remarkable thing is that we played a song before we had introduced each other.
Right. The power of music, man.
Yeah, and so we played the two scheduled shows, and after the first warm-up show, he squeezed his way through the sardine-packed crowd, and he says, Frank, what do you say we put a quartet together and do some corporate gigs? Would you fancy that? I would fancy that.
I would fancy that. That's so cool, man.
So we started playing, and then I helped him put a band together. And we did, I organized the music with Tommy. We did a couple years of that and all over the world. And then we opened for Eric Clapton. So, you know, we've been touring off and on since way back then. And that led me to, and then Pete Townsend liked my work with Tommy. And so he called me up and I had met him and we had a really nice conversation. We just like, talk about simpatico. I mean, we just immediate friends. And, talking about our intimate, you know, stories from our lives and everything like that. And Pete and I got along great. And then he called me and he wanted me to help him organize the music for the 2012 Olympics.
Oh, he was putting that together.
Yeah. And so he wanted me to help him with the sequencing and all that.
Holy shit. Pete Townsend asking you to help with sequencing from a guy who's the king of sequencing.
Well, he invented.
But he wanted pretty me much.
To just like piece it together because he wanted, it was going to be kind of a medley and he just wanted someone to bounce ideas off of, you know. And
wow.
So I had to do that. I got screen credit for that, unbelievably.
That's cool, man.
And then the next thing I heard from Pete, and he wanted me to help him arrange all the music of Quadrophenia. And so I did. And that was the beginning of my hard work arranging it all, you know, horn parts, vocal parts, lead sheets.
When you say arranging, can you speak, what does that actually mean?
Well, some of the synthesized, I don't know if you know Quadrophenia.
I know that album very well, yeah.
Okay, so well, a lot of the synthesizer parts were kind of like horn parts, you know, ba, ba,
yeah.
You know, so those kinds of horn parts, they were, so I arranged them in five instruments, trumpet, 1, 2, 3, trombone, and a euphonium.
So when you say arrangement, you mean like you wrote parts out or?
So I would extract some of the synthesizer parts and then add to it if some parts need, you know, like an orchestrator would. Mm. Take certain essential elements and then expound on it.
Yeah.
And so I did that, you know. And some of it would be related to like guitar lines, you know, if they were like double parts or triple parts, you know, I would extract them and then turn them into horn parts. And so we actually, for the Quadrophenia tour, we had two horn players that could play all those instruments. And I played three of the horns and the two guys played, trumpet 1 or 2 or.
How are you playing three horns?
Well, I had sampled, you know, I could play them on keyboards.
Oh, okay. Okay. Wild.
Yeah, they were sampled horn parts, and then I also played banjo and mandolin and some percussion on one song and background vocals.
You said what was the thing you said? Euphonium? You said an instrument.
Euphonium, yeah. It's like a small tuba.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's the kinds of, you know, well, there are three low brass instruments. There's the sousaphone, which is the big one for marching.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's the orchestral tuba, mm-hmm. which is, you know, it's about that big. And then there's a euphonium, which is like the smaller version of that.
Okay, I never heard that.
Euphonium. Yeah.
So you did all the arranging to set up so that when you went out, you could perform it.
I could perform it, and then I could write out charts for the two horn players that came along. And
so you did a lot of work for those guys.
That was a lot of work. Horn parts for all of Quadrophenia, and not to mention string parts, because we were talking about using a string quartet as well. And so I did string charts as well.
Holy cow.
String quartet charts, and then I did all the vocal charts. Oh, my God, that was a lot of work, too. I mean, and it wasn't just for Quadrophenia. We did, a quick one while he's away. That one.
Happy Jack.
That's like, I think, 9 or 11 vocal parts. I mean, there's a full-on score. It's like 90 pages long.
Holy smokes.
Well, some of these scores, you wouldn't believe how much work went into them.
How long were you with? You're not with those guys now, but.
Well, I'm not doing this summer or the fall because they're using an orchestra, and they don't need a guy to play horns.
Yeah.
They already have horns in the orchestra, and I guess playing the banjo and mandolin on a couple songs didn't really.
It isn't just, yeah.
Yeah, although I did all the background vocals. They're going to miss a couple of us not having vocals. I know that, but
Such as how long were you with those guys?
Well, since the Olympics, so 7 years.
Oh, wow, that's a long time.
Yeah, but they said, well, we don't use an orchestra next time you're back on. So, as far as I know.
Sure, that's really cool. What was what is the deal with Roger Daltrey? That guy has like the best genetics of any human being I've ever seen. He's like ripped and shredded, and he's got to be in his 70s now, man. You don't see him that much without a shirt on, but you did 5 to 10 years ago, even walking around, Is he just like, does he work out all the time? Or is he incredibly gifted?
He works out pretty much every day, and he's very conscientious about nutrients and drinking the right kind of water, ionized water and alkaline water and all those kinds of things. And he works out a lot, and his voice in particular, when we first started, he was just, he would thrash his voice, but he started getting the surgery at the Voices in Boston, and a lot of musicians, including Steven Tyler and Christina Perry and a bunch of singers have gotten that surgery, and they've had 100% success rate with it.
That's really cool.
And so you can't speak for a month after the surgery, but after that, you sound like you're young again.
Wow. Yeah. It's funny you mentioned Christina Perry. This is kind of funny. Her brother Nick is a great guitar player. I don't know if you know Nick Perry. He's in Orange County, and he's been professional since he's like 16. And so one day, and I don't know Christina's music, but I walk into my daughter's room one day. She's 19 now. This happened 6 months ago, and I said, "Wow, that sounds great. Who is that?" She goes, "Oh, it's Christina Perry." I said, "Really?" I said, "I know her brother." She goes, "No, you don't." So I sent Nick a text, and I said, "Could you please tell my daughter that I?" And he sends back a text and shows Sam. And she's like, "Holy crap!" Small world, man. Wow.
Yeah.
So, talk about playing with the Who at Hyde Park in front of 85,000 fans and what that was like. That's like a hometown concert for those guys.
Yeah. It was, just an incredibly high honor to, play in London outside at this famous park where they've played before, but, I'm a part of the band and Pete, gives me all these accolades about, he's the guy who put all this music together, and it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Not HBO, but what was that, I forgot which TV station showed this.
Showtime, maybe?
Yeah, Showtime. That's what it is. Showtime. Mm. And his introduction is, I think, in that concert. The introduction of me.
That's so cool, man.
And, he says some really nice things about I helped, make the music happen.
That's really cool, man. The first time you hear Roger singing, I'm assuming you had monitors in ears?
Yeah.
And you're on stage. Was that kind of like surreal? Because like, I'm sure you grew up listening to him like I did and everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Was it weird?
Yeah. To hear that voice, that iconic voice, It's really the godfather of rock vocals, you know. Even Robert Plant thinks so. I've talked to Robert, you know, well, I said, Robert, you know, you are the legendary vocalist. And he goes, no. Because Roger is the godfather.
Well, when you hear him sing Love Rain Over Me, it's like, that's got to be giving you chills, man.
Yeah,
you
know, plus, I mean, the song is so amazing.
Oh, yeah.
It might, you know, be arguably the best rock song ever written.
Oh, it's a great track, man.
You know, playing that song was just, it just soars. And I played horns on that song. So I know.
Well, that's epic. There's a bunch of horns going on the end of that song. Yeah. The climax.
There are a lot of lines. There are counterpuntal music within it. You know, there's the descending line in the chorus, and that's in harmony. And so there's that. There's piano. There's synthesizer. There are those octaves and fifths, you know, with the violin.
And that descending line.
Yeah, there's a descending line.
It goes on forever.
Yeah.
It goes on for a long time. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Talk about what you're working on now that you're excited about, because I know you got a bunch of things you're doing with your speaking. And
right. I just started doing speaking engagements at colleges and universities, and it's about music, science, and enlightenment, how they all connect. And it's sort of a no-nonsense lecture on redefining spirituality in my own way. It's unpretentious, and I talk about the science of subatomic particles, like electrons, and about quantum physics, and about the neuroscience of music, neurochemistry, about, you know, how music affects our endocrine system, all sorts of science, and I connect them. I alternate the science with personal music career stories.
What made you decide to want to do that? Like, have you spoken before, or?
I kind of surprised myself when I was asked to do a talk at the English department at a college, and I basically gave that same speech, and I came up with what I thought was a clever idea, which is it's called A Conversation with the Universe, and I'm asking the universe questions and the universe answering, and I had three big questions to ask the universe, and the first one being, you know, what is the universe made of, and the second one was, what's the meaning of life?
That's a quick question.
How important is knowledge? Anyway, so I went and did that, and the chair of the music department from that college was there, and he said, "Oh my gosh, you got to give this to at the large hall." And so I just gave it to about 300 people, and I'm pretty comfortable up there talking about my stories and about the science. You know, I have a real keen interest in science, and, you know, neuroscience, cosmology, astrophysics, physics in general, physics of sound, all kinds of science, biology.
Sure.
You know, the origin of life, you know, all that. I can't read enough of it. I read about 5 articles a day.
Let me ask this. Was it different? You've performed in front of 85,000 people.
Yeah.
Were you just as comfortable speaking, or was it, 'cause, you know, everybody, you know, there's the toughest thing in the world, you know, the thing that makes people more nervous is public speaking. Or did you feel comfortable doing that? Not a problem at all.
I feel pretty comfortable. It's like I get nervous on the way there. On the way there, I think, oh, are people really going to be interested in what I want to talk about? You know, these kinds of, you know.
Oh, so you got the little voice talking to you here.
Yeah. You know, the little voice in your, in your prefrontal cortex, the little, you know, the ego, you know, like telling you, you're going to be okay with this, you know?
Yeah.
But once I get there and I feel like I'm, you know, resonating with the crowd, I feel like I captured their attention, you know, made them laugh a little or whatever it is. And I feel like I have their attention. I'm really comfortable up there. And, so I just, gave a talk recently, well, in Colorado, and I had no problem. I start off playing the guitar, which helps.
Oh, that's cool.
I feel grounded. I do this 1-minute, 20-second fiery guitar solo at the beginning of my talk, and then I talk about what it feels like to catch fire.
Oh, that's cool, man.
actually intend to catch fire as I'm playing. And I jump up and I do a Pete Townsend. I land and I start talking. You
know? Oh, that's so really cool.
Tell people what that feels like right away.
Okay, so you get them engaged right away. That's really cool, man.
Music. And so I play a little music, you know. When I play a little Bach when I'm talking about insomnia. And play my song when I was 17 called Anniversary. And
what was that about?
Oh, it's about the anniversary of my death, actually. But it's just sort of a retrospective.
The anniversary. Wait.
No, like my the future anniversary, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, and so it's just like I never know when that's going to be, and so but really, it's a reflective song about my whole life.
Hmm. And you wrote that at 17.
Well, I wrote those lyrics. I wrote a different set of lyrics when I was 17, but I wrote 90% of the music when I was 17.
And then the lyrics came along later.
The lyrics, yeah. I had a different set of lyrics when I was 17, which aren't very good. So I replaced them later in life.
You could probably replace them once a year if it's about the anniversary of your death, because you have all sorts of different thoughts about that as you move right along, you know?
It's really not about my death. It's really, ironically, it's more about my life.
Sure.
You know, about, you know, like, yeah, that day is going to pass every year of my life, but,
yeah,
you know, but it's really about about a reflective song about my life.
Is it possible to choose top three musical experiences that you've had, or maybe knee-jerk reaction to the?
Well, my daughters wrote a song for me and sang it to me. They wrote a song called Dad for a big birthday party bash I had, and it stopped the party for an hour. All the guys in the room had tears in their eyes and they couldn't speak.
That is really sweet, man.
It was just so knocked out. I couldn't speak either. My two girls, Audrey and Jessica, wrote the song, and they took our breath away.
Are they both musical?
Oh yeah, incredible singers. And the two, my older daughter plays double bass, and my middle daughter plays all the percussion instruments. And they're when they sing together, it's like listening to two angels sing.
Well, you said middle daughter. You have two or three? Oh,
so I have my middle daughter, and then I have a boy.
Okay. So yeah.
And my younger daughters.
Okay.
Yeah.
You did the reverse. I mean,
and she's an artist. Excuse me?
No, I said that's sort of like I have two sons and a daughter, so I get it. I get what you're saying. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So they're both incredible singers. And
that's great, man.
And they sang the song called Dad that just, I should send it to you. It was like, you know, how can I explain?
That's cool that of all this stuff you've done, play with Mick and Pete and Roger and Don Henley, mm-hmm, and this and that. That's really cool. Number one is the songs that your daughter.
Second thing I did, I guess, playing with Paul McCartney, next to Paul McCartney, I sang Hey Jude.
What was standing this?
This was Don Henley opened for Paul McCartney on Earth Day 1993.
Oh.
And end of the show. Our tour manager rounded it. We were watching Paul McCartney. I had never seen a Beatle perform. Hmm. And so I was knocked out by that, just that.
Yeah.
Then our tour manager came around and rounded us up and said, Paul wants you backstage. So we all went, oh, whatever that is, we're going back there. So sure. We went and the production manager, Paul's production manager, said, you know, when the time comes, he wants you to get up on the stage, we're going to line the foot of the stage with microphones. And when the time comes, Paul wants you to go up there and sing Hey Jude with him. So I went up and I didn't want to be too greedy. So I didn't want to take the spot right next to Paul, which turned out to be good karma, because right before he started Hey Jude, he goes, I'm going to invite a couple of my old friends up. And one of them was Ringo Starr. So Ringo Starr took that spot that I would have taken.
So you stood next to Ringo.
I stood next to two of the Beatles.
That's so cool.
And sang Hey Jude and in front of at the Hollywood Bowl.
And who was his guitarist then, if you remember? McCartney.
Oh, he was the Wings guy.
Oh, Denny Lane.
Oh, yeah, maybe it was Denny Lane, but there was one other guy. What was his name? I'd have to look that
okay.
up.
Okay. Just curious.
Yeah, I can't recall his name, but anyway. Anyway, so we sang Hey Jude, and then we locked eyes, and he took his guitar off, his left-handed Les Paul, he set it down, he came over to me, and we locked eyes, and he put out his hands to me, and I put my hands in his, we shook him like this, And I go, this is it, isn't it, Paul? And he goes, yes, it is. And then he let go and he went to the piano and played the rest of the song.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really cool, man.
So it was like a kind of almost a religious experience with, two of the Beatles.
And that was in 93, you said, on Earth Day.
Yeah.
Right. Earth Day is 420, is that what that is?
Something like that.
Yeah, I think it's August. I think it's April 20, which has become Weed Day for some reason.
Oh, Weed Day.
Yeah, like you never heard of that? Your girls are older. Yeah, it's like it's the day of, it's an excuse to go out and get stoned. 420, yeah. Okay. As if they need an excuse. And what would be number three?
Let's see. Well, a peak experience was when I was 14 and I went in front of a crowd of about 10,000 people at Hibiya Gardens at a music festival. And I had major butterflies in my stomach, but I was on fire. I was only 14, and that was the band that had the record deal offered to us. So that was
in Japan or
Japan. It was in Japan. It was a rock festival in Tokyo. And we got a slot. We played three songs, I think.
That's crazy that you're doing this at 14, man.
Yeah, I was 10 in front of 10,000 people.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was intense. Of course, meeting Mick Jagger and Pete Townsend, it's crazy to meet these people and hang out with them, have dinner with them or have long conversations with them, the people I grew up with when I was in Japan, that was so far away and I don't know.
No, I totally get it, man. I totally get what you're talking about. Because I've had people on this show and it's like, I'm not starstruck, but I'm like, how did I used to listen to this record. And yeah, so I get it totally, man.
Yeah. I was just a little kid listening to Tommy, and going, wow, this is amazing, And then I wind up doing those songs with him.
With him on stage.
And he's going, Frank, he helped us put all this music together. And, he's a fantastic guitar player. Pete Townsend would introduce me like, he's a fantastic. Well, of course, we can't let him play in The Who.
Yeah.
Or in The Who, but he's still a fantastic guitar player. He thought I was great,
That's really cool, man. Let me ask you this. What advice, in looking back, would you have wanted to give yourself or would have helped you, assuming you and you were younger, you would have been open to hearing it? And it could be anything, music, life, just advice that you would have made your life easier.
Being open and honest and being focused, being communicative, connecting with people and not hiding. As I said earlier, paying attention to the details because details are the work. Enthusiasm, no matter what, wasn't it Ralph Waldo Emerson who said, nothing great is ever achieved without enthusiasm, and I totally agree with that. When I play, I'm full of it. I'm just I try to fill that moment with enthusiasm and I also, I guess I had a illusion about success, and it really is an illusion. I think it's a myth for the most part. I felt like I was living with a shame when I had a band called the Whiz Kids. We put out a single on this custom label on A&M. We had a record deal offered. Well, three record companies offered us deals: Polygram Capital and Columbia. And our manager screwed everything up. He was demanding way too much money. And he screwed up we just wanted to make a record. So the whole thing was devastating for us because we didn't get the record deal. And I started having panic attacks. And, I think I was trying to measure myself. Like, if I didn't get that record deal, I had failed myself.
Yeah.
And I should have just picked up the pieces and just tried to get another deal or, write another batch of stuff or put another band together or I don't know. But I was so... felt ashamed or, like I didn't measure up and, I think success in that frame of mind, in that context is an illusion. And, what you have though is your concentration. I felt like I'd lost my concentration back then. I felt like I had lost my ability to focus. And you can never lose that, because that's what you have. And that would be kind of a overarching philosophy to live by, I think.
Thanks, man.
Yeah.
Hey, let's talk about gear for a few minutes. What are you like? What's your go-to guitar? I'm sure you got a bunch of guitars, but which ones do you like picking up? Top three.
My 62 Strat, Rosewood Strat. It's all beat up and it's got a story. All my guitars have stories.
Yeah, well, tell me the story with it.
Well, the Stratocaster, a friend of mine, not a close friend, but he was walking on this down a sidewalk in Sacramento. And he saw this street musician playing the 62 Strat, my Strat, and the 61 Strat. And he had a trumpet chained around his neck. And the trumpet kept bashing up against the Strat. And so it was all beat up. And my friend asked him, so would you ever sell those guitars? And the street musician goes, I wouldn't sell them for $500 each, you know. And my friend goes, well, would you sell them for $1,000? And meanwhile, they're going for about $5,000 or $6,000. And the street musician said, $1,000? You're going to pay $1,000 for my guitar? Oh, yeah, sure, I'll sell them for you. So my friend ran to the bank, got $2,000, handed it to him, and picked up the 61 and 62 Strat and brought them home.
Oh, my God. So you took one, he took the other one.
Yeah, well, the other one went to a friend of mine, another guitar player, I got the other one. I got the superior of the two. I thought the 62 Strat came from Sacramento or from the streets.
That's a great story, man. God.
So wow. My second guitar is a 56 Telecaster, and I bought it at Guitar. What was that place that sold vintage guitars? Anyway, he sold me this really just incredible Telecaster that just roars through my Marshall 100, the Plexi, and it's a special Tele. And anyway, it turned out that the front pickup, which I never used, was a DiMarzio. I knew that the store owner had looked to see what kind of a pickup it was. So I went back to him. I go, hey, you lied about this pickup. You knew that it was a DiMarzio in the front pickup, although I never use it. And he says, all right. You got me there. Okay, well.
He told you it was an original 56 Tele pickup.
The whole thing's original except the frets. So I said, well, you know. So he goes, okay, you got me. Okay, yeah. Okay. Be reasonable. You can pick a guitar off the wall and just take it home.
Oh, so you got to pick another guitar.
Yeah, I got a Thunderbird bass, Gibson Thunderbird 1 for free. So that's my other story.
Wow, this is to show you how much the value of original. Yeah.
I didn't really care.
Very cool. And what would be number three?
Number three, well, I've had a 54 gold top all my life, and I bought it when I on Santa Monica Boulevard back in a long time ago when I was playing with the Whiz Kids, and it's kind of a, you know, there's a place in my heart I have a connection with that 54 gold top. I used to play it with the band the Whiz Kids. And
is that P90s in that?
It's a P90s, yeah. It's a soap bars.
Wow.
So I bought it for $1,050. Nobody wanted it. It was selling for $1,580. I remember that. And they couldn't sell it, so they dropped the price to $1,350. And then I said, look, all I have is $1,050. Would you sell it to me? And they begrudgingly said, yeah, all right, go ahead. I know you want this guitar.
Why wasn't anybody buying that?
It was gold tops were not popular at the time.
Oh, really? Wow, you got a hell of a deal. I mean, that was a lot of money back then. When did you buy it?
77.
Yeah, that was a lot of bread back then. That's really cool. That's awesome. Wow, what a guitar. That must sound amazing.
Yeah, it does. It really does. Still sounds great.
And it sounds like you got a bunch of cool amps too.
Yeah, I've got the, you wanted to know what I thought were my Cup 2 top amps. So my Marshall Plexi 100, 1967. It's like a same year, like, I think Jimi Hendrix used, and it really is hard to top. And I use in the studio I've used a 57 Tweed Deluxe that I really like. the Fender Tweed Deluxe. And yeah, and then there's a Friedman Dirty Shirley that I use sometimes. But
that's a great name.
Yeah.
Dirty
really, those two, you know, those two vintage amps are really. I've used AC30s and AC15s, AC50s too. So
you like those, the Vox?
You know, yeah. I mean, they can sound good. You know, not all of them sound great. Not all Marshall Plexis sound good. I have a Marshall 50 that I shouldn't say it because I'm trying to sell it. But so keep that out of the interview. I'm not, but I have a like a mint condition Plexi 50 that I never use.
It just doesn't appeal. Yeah, but somebody else will like it. Somebody else might like it. You know.
Yeah, someone else might like it. Yeah.
You ever meet?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if you know this guy, Greg Martin from the Kentucky Headhunters.
No.
He plays Plexis. He has a collection of them. That's all he plays. He sounds great, man.
Yeah.
Best guitar and best amp you've ever owned. And you might have told me them already, so.
I think the Tele and the Marshall, that's it for me.
Wow.
The two together, I mean, if you play some Led Zeppelin, like, you know, Heartbreaker or something, it just sounds like the record. It just, it's like, it really does.
Desert Island Discs, Frank. Just for now. I mean, you can't pick one forever.
Let's see. Oh. You know, I love Revolver.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see. Oh, I have to think about this one because too many things come to mind. But too many, you know, Jimi Hendrix. Are you experienced? I think, you know, Jimi Hendrix. Maybe Led Zeppelin too. You know, I listen to all kinds of music, but.
Very cool, man.
Yeah.
All right. So this is like the difficult questions part. Most important things you've learned about yourself through your life and career experience.
About myself. I guess I'm a survivor. That I have pretty strong survival instincts. I try to integrate my intellect and my sense of, you know, social bonding and ability to communicate musically and verbally. I just sort of combined all the creative aspects of my life with my social abilities and made the best of it. And that all puts into my survival, I think.
You're a guy who's super bright. That's oftentimes you got people who are really bright and that it's, they're socially awkward. I don't get the sense that you're socially awkward at all.
Yeah, well, I can be a loner type, you know, because I'm so, I can just be lost in like being creative. Like if I'm doing a film score or writing music for something or television show or something, I'm lost in that work, you know, or I'm, writing a classical piece on the guitar or something like that. And I feel like I don't have to go visit anybody.
Yeah.
Have anybody over. I'm just completely content doing that. And I'll go on for 14 hours straight and forget to eat dinner, you know. So, yeah, I can be antisocial in that respect, you know, because I'm so immersed in creative work.
Yeah.
But, you know, I enjoy the company of others. And,
yeah.
You know, I don't like crowds so much. I don't like being in a huge crowd, but. I have.
I was going to say, that's tough when you're playing with people this caliber, you know.
Well, you know, standing on stage is one thing, but to be in the crowd
okay.
is another. You know, like when you're exiting and entering and all that stuff.
Hmm.
But while I'm doing it, I'm okay with it too.
It's funny. Most of the musicians I've interviewed, it's getting close to 500. Probably 90% feel that way. They're, you know, where they're comfortable with people, but at the same time, they're just as comfortable. Which I think you have to become a successful musician. I mean, you could practicing in your room alone pretty much for 8 hours a day or however, you know, you got to be comfortable with yourself in isolation.
Yeah.
You know, you can't be, you know.
You rise, you know, the thing I say in my talk is, you know, you rise above that the tyrant of the conscious mind. You know, you like, you know, there's like that other person that lives there, which is your ego, you know, and you rise above that. You know, you forget about that person. You're outside your skin when you're playing music. So those hours go by. You don't even think about yourself as the self.
Yeah.
You know, you're just sort of blended in with the cosmos. And, you know, that coalescence is, to me, it's a kind of bliss or rapture or enlightenment. I just feel completely connected and content, you know. It's like what people who meditate are trying to achieve.
Yeah.
They're trying to be outside their skin, you know. You know, Buddhists meditate all their lives and try to achieve that state.
This is a tough question, man. Okay. What do you like most about yourself?
Huh? Oh.
This is the first pause we've had in an hour and 20 minutes.
See, I don't think about myself so much. Maybe, you know, what do I like about myself? That, you know, I have a handle on that, you know, creativity is central to my life.
And you're aware of that. Yeah.
And I think the universe is, I mean, my whole philosophy on the universe and myself is that, you know, we're all one thing, one essence, one organism, and creativity is the interface. You know, I mean, the universe is inherently creative and, you know, creates planets, stars, biology, brains, hearts, music. And so to partake in it is very natural, and I feel like I have a handle on that. Maybe that's my saving grace. I think it is for most people. I mean, we're doing creative things as we're talking. I mean, we're doing something creative right now.
Yeah.
Exchange ideas, you know, taking photographs, having a conversation, writing a letter, writing an email, you know, just playing guitar. It doesn't have to be something that's obviously creative. You know,
yeah.
Everything is a creative act. Having children, raising kids, you know, having a sense of style when you go shopping. That's creative too. Everything's creative, you know.
Yeah,
how you handle yourself in company. That's all creative.
It's relaxing to think of it like that, because you don't think of it as a mistake that way. Yeah. I was just thinking this as you said it. I'm like, yeah, you know what? If you take the pressure, this is just a thing. You know, this is you doing something new or whatever. It kind of takes the pressure off a little bit.
Yeah. And, you know, you're just part of it's this creative process you're a part of. And so I think it takes the heat off of, you know, the responsibility of just like, you're a one individual trying to portray yourself a certain way or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, you don't come off as false because you're just sort of, you know, it's an interplay of engagement with others and with everything else.
Yeah.
The environment. So it's less about control. It's more about pleasure.
Yes. That's important. What you just said, I think, tell me something about yourself that people would be either surprised to hear or might find a little odd.
Well, early on, I wanted to first be a film director when I was like 6 or 7 years old.
And then it's amazing you had that. It's so young.
And then I wanted to be a magician when I was about 8 or 9. And all the magicians' pros talked me out of it.
Why?
And they said, you'll never make any money. They said, don't do it, Frank.
It's great to pick up girls, man.
Yeah, well, I can still do magic. So, and then thirdly, I was thinking about becoming a lawyer or an English professor.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, that's kind of surprising. I didn't think too many people know that. I almost went to law school. You know, but my grandfather was a judge and my father was a judge and a lawyer, and it was sort of natural for me to. I mean, even the Who, between Roger Daltrey and Pete Townsend, they call me the adjudicator, the mediator, the
diplomat. You negotiate things between those two guys.
Oh yeah, they're like two totally different personalities. I can go in between them and kind of calm them down and make things work, and you know, when things are ready to collapse, you know. And I mean, the Who guys are pretty fiery, and you know, it's very volatile, and you know, I just go on and we just show up to rehearsal and work this out, you know.
That's funny. After all these years, I still like that.
Yeah. So I'm good at that. You know, so you were asking me, what do I like about my, I'm a good diplomat.
Good diplomat.
Yeah, I know I have that ability to interject diplomacy into potentially hostile situations.
Happiest time in your life?
When I was growing up in Tokyo for the first probably 7 years of my life, living like a prince and living beautiful surroundings, Japanese garden, three architects, we were living in this amazing community. My dad's Harvard classmate lived two doors away, and his place looked like a golf course, and they owned the electrical grid in Tokyo.
Holy smokes.
Yeah. And next door neighbor was an English millionaire, had a white Rolls Royce and chauffeur driven. And, my dad's house was the smallest, but it was still huge. And,
yeah.
And I lived like, everything was in perfect order, and, waking up my third birthday and seeing all the presents I wanted, some plastic tools, and it was all there. And
it's amazing you remember that, man. Third birthday. That's an early memory, man.
Third birthday, yeah. And I said, wow, everything's in place,
Do you ever get back to Tokyo, or is any of your family still there?
Some work over there. I have a commercial that's like, I wrote a song that became central to a campaign, a Honda scooter and motorcycle campaign. And so I still do business over there.
Okay.
And I have one song was a theme song for a drama for about 5 years. And I had a record deal in Japan too with Sony. And so I put out a record there. So yeah, I've been, business. I produced a singer there.
Oh, your kids are here though, right?
Yeah, my kids are here. My oldest daughter's in Boston. My younger daughter is in St. Louis. She's a fantastic artist, multimedia artist, multidisciplinary artist. And my boy lives with me.
That's awesome, man.
Did I answer all of those questions? I hope I didn't evade.
No, you answered every single one. I got a few more left. Any non-musical superpowers?
Superpowers. Superpowers. What can I do? Let's see. I've written award-winning poetry. I can do professional-level card tricks, magic, and I speak fluent Japanese.
That is pretty cool. You know what? This is a tough question, man. What is the most important thing your dad taught you?
I remember saying, because Frank, the shy and retiring often miss out a lot in life.
Is your dad like a pretty stoic guy?
He was, he had a wry sense of humor, and he was just he was as scholarly as he was. I might have mentioned that he spoke 9 languages.
Yeah, that's crazy.
He formed the language of the new Japanese Constitution in English. They had the English version of the Japanese Constitution. He formed some of the language of that.
And,
so he had a hand in part of the making of Far Eastern history. Really just brilliant guy. I mean, over breakfast, as I said, he could do 3 crossword puzzles, LA Times, New York Times, and San Diego Union, or whatever. He'd be having a conversation with me, and in between, he'd be filling in the crossword puzzle, and they would all be done by the end of breakfast. I remember I asked him, Dad, what is the difference between avoid and ignore? I was 15. What is the difference between avoid and ignore? And he goes, the level of consciousness is what he said. I go, good answer.
Oh, my God. That's pretty funny. Avoid and ignore the level of consciousness.
Oh, he said to my aunt one time, he said, Margaret, his sister, younger sister, goes, you mentioned the obvious with the greatest profundity.
Wow. So he didn't speak and only used SAT words.
Well, he didn't.
Academics
always
are like that, man.
Yeah,
they just
went to Harvard when he was 16. He knew Latin and Greek by the time he was, he had to read Greek read the Homer's Odyssey in Greek in the 10th grade, and in Latin poetry, you know, Aeneid, you know, in his 12th grade, you know, and then he went to college and had to know French and German, and he had to know Latin. And, I mean, well, I already said that, but I mean, you know, and he learned Turkish in about 4 months, and he could speak Mandarin and Russian, you know.
What did he, why did he, like, just for hobby? Like, what did he?
Well, he was an international lawyer, so he, you know, it helped him when he,
to get,
you know,
clients talking, yeah.
To learn the language.
I get you.
He spoke Japanese as well. So what was your question? You said, what was the most important
thing he taught you?
To keep your calm.
Are you good with that? Or do you tend to keep things calm, or have you tended to?
Yeah, I have both sides. I get, you know, emotionally intense, and then I have a counterbalancing side of my personality that I'm like, okay, now hang on, everybody. It's true, you know. Let's calm down.
I got three more questions for you, Frank, and thank you for everything. Anything you wish you've done differently?
Oh. Not really. I have no regrets. I mean, you know, yeah, if I had two other clones, one would have been a fine artist. The other one would have become a lawyer or English professor. I would have done that. There are other interests too. Like I would have studied neuroscience. Hmm. You know, I love neuroscience to that degree that if I had more time, I would have gotten a degree in it. I have that much interest in the neuroscience.
Yeah, but that's not something that you'd done differently, I don't think.
I guess not. You know, I would have gone to school to study more science, but I make up for it by reading more sort of lay literature about neuroscience and physics. And
yeah, sure. You could glean so much from reading, especially online nowadays. It's not even funny. I mean,
But there's, you know, if you take a class like in Shakespeare, or James Joyce or something like that, you know, you learn things from the teacher and from the other students that you wouldn't learn, you can't learn on your own.
Yes.
So, I mean, some of the references or, you know, allusions, you know, literary allusions, things that Shakespeare or Joyce or someone like that, you know, makes, you really have to take a class in it to get more out of it, to get more than you would if you just did it on your own.
Sure. Anything you regret not doing?
Anything I regret? Spending more time with my mother and my sister. And my sister passed away in 2 years ago.
I'm sorry, she's young.
Well, not so young, but, you know, she... I was really close to her. Just we were on the same wavelength, and we shared a sense of humor. We were the fixers, the vaccine fixers of all the family issues, and we could talk for hours. And I just got to see her once 2 years ago, and then she passed away.
Sorry, man.
Yeah, she was the closest. I mean, my mother and my sister were really the closest member of my family. I have a brother too, who's very successful, you know, guy in finance. Hmm. Another Harvard graduate.
God, this is amazing. You got all these. There's obviously something genetic going on there, man, to have that brain power. And last question: biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of that change has been intentional, and how much is just a natural part of aging?
I think the ability to be an observer in going through life, rather than being stuck in that mode of the conscious, you know, the aspect of the mind, which is, you know, related to being egotistically motivated or ego-oriented, you know, to just step back from yourself and... View yourself, you know, I view myself.
Sure.
So I have that ability to kind of like when things get too intense or they start, I feel like I'm getting riled up or feeling anxious or something like that, I just step back and I'm able to kind of view myself from a more objectively, and that calms me down almost immediately. I feel like I'm reaching a sort of equilibrium, you know, emotionally, spiritually, whatever you want to say, so existentially, you know, just sort of not be so in the world.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, depression is the inability to do that, I think, you know, maybe a component of depression, or, you know, like if you're feeling suicidal or something, it's like you're too much in the world, you know, and to step back and go, hey, you know, think about this for a second. You just kind of give yourself a little bit of distance rather than just so being so into yourself and viewing the world through the lens of your mind. You know, you're still using your mind when you're being more objective, but you're being more less subjective.
It's funny. I've been a consultant in marketing for 20 years, working for myself, and whenever I have a problem, I always say, okay, what would I do if I was a client of mine? Mm-hmm. I never think, because then it takes all the, exactly what you're talking about away. It's like, okay, here's the advice I'd give this guy. And then it makes it much easier, you know, looking at yourself, not as yourself, it always makes things much easier, which is what you're talking about, I think.
Right.
Yeah. Much
easier.
It takes the pressure off. Yeah, and you're able to like get an honest, a non-emotional, honest answer, which is even, you know, it's a resolution or solution, you know, which is great. Yeah. Hey, listen, I just want to say I can't thank you enough, man. You're very candid, and it's super interesting, man. And I just want to tell people where they could check you out and find out more information about you. First of all, it's Frank Symes, S-I-M-E-S, and if you want information on booking Frank or talking to him about keynote speaking on music, science, and enlightenment, which clearly he knows a hell of a lot about all three, go to thebigstrum.com, and there's a contact form there. It's thebigstrum, B-I-G-S-T-R-U-M. He's also, man, you've written a memoir and you're working. I'm doing the New York thing. And you're working on your second book. Talk about those.
Okay, so it's my memoir is about 315 pages, and being shown to literary agents, and I'm going to be probably talking to one today. And so the second book is the one about music, science, and enlightenment, and I'm just in the midst of working on that, and I'm working on so many other projects that I have to figure out, you know, find the time to finish my book.
Oh, and prioritize. Yeah, well, you know, that book will get you gigs from a marketing standpoint. That'll get you gigs, speaking gigs.
I could take my keynote talk and just make it into a short book.
Absolutely.
So I might do that, and I can actually, I have some, you know, things I can add to it. Then some other
checklists, man. Top 10 things to do. This and that. That's so really helpful.
Chapter on Pythagoras, chapter on Albert Einstein, chapter on Carl Sagan, all these different things that relate to my talk, and you know, chapter on the science of large numbers and things like that.
You know? Yeah, man, that'll get you gigs for sure.
Yeah.
And also, Frank is available, obviously, to play guitar, arrange music, or if you're looking for a music director, if you want to talk about that stuff with him, please be serious and, you know, respect his time. But you could email him at Frank Symes. Again, that's Frank, S-I-M-E-S, at gmail.com. And that's it, man. Did I miss anything?
No, I think that's it.
I really appreciate your time, and I enjoyed talking with you. Super bright guy. You had me on my toes the whole time.
I certainly enjoyed talking with you. You're very bright yourself. Maybe there's something we could do together, like as I publish these books or whatever, or self-publish them or whatever happens. You're in marketing, and maybe you could show me the ropes for getting it, you know, out there somehow more.
I can give you a few ideas for sure, man. I'm happy to talk to you about that.
That sounds
everybody. Yeah, everybody, thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this, share it with your friends on your social media channels. Appreciate your support. Thanks very much to Frank Symes for spending time with us. Don't forget to look Frank up. Check out thebigstrum.com and see what you can do with Frank. I really appreciate you doing that. Make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list so you and I can connect. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice. Go play your guitar and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.